Welcome to Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. Today we'll look at a number of subjects in the news. We'll begin in a moment and go to Alaska and speak with Shannon Moore, progressive radio broadcaster in Anchorage. She has interviewed Republican vice presidential nominee and Governor Sarah Palin a number of times and is now under threat of lawsuit from Governor Palin. We'll be talking to her about the threats from the governor who just announced that she's stepping down and... Speculation is, of course, that she will run for president in 2012. Then we'll talk about the fiscal crisis here in California and among many, many state governments. We'll be joined by Max Nyman, who's a senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute in California, and Todd Haggerty, a research analyst at the National Conference of State Legislatures. And then we'll talk with Rhys Ehrlich, a freelance journalist and author. His books include the 2003 bestseller Target Iraq, What's the News, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, and in 2007, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy in the Middle East Crisis. And last week he published an article entitled Iran and Leftist Confusion. We'll be talking about leftist confusion with Rhys Ehrlich, and then we'll speak with Michael Shifter, who's the Vice President for Policy and Director of the Andean Program, the Inter-American Dialogue. And he's also an adjunct professor of Latin American politics at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. We'll be talking to him about the latest from Honduras, where it appears Honduran military have threatened to arrest the ousted leader if he returns. So I'm now speaking with Shannon Moore, her progressive radio broadcaster in Anchorage, Alaska. She pioneered political talk radio for women in the 49th state and has on her program has interviewed Republican vice presidential nominee and Governor Sarah Palin a number of times. And, of course, Shannon, you received a letter from Sarah Palin's private attorney suggesting that, in fact, putting you on notice. Can I just read it briefly here? From the letter, to the extent several websites, notably liberal Alaskan blogger Shannon Moore, are now claiming as fact that Governor Palin resigned because she is under federal investigation for embezzlement and other criminal wrongdoings. We will be exploring legal options this week to address such defamation. This is to provide notice to Ms. Moore and those who republish the defamation, such as the Huffington Post, MSNBC, the New York Times, and the Washington Post, that the Palins will not allow them to propagate defamatory material without answering to this in a court of law. So do you want to go ahead and put yourself in legal jeopardy?
Well, I'm wondering are you going to read what I wrote? What I had posted up?
No, well, I think you fill us in, because the idea is from this, what I get from this letter is they're trying to stop you from talking. And
It's a four-page sit down and shut up letter is what it is.
Right.
You know, I found it really ironic that on Independence Day, you know, that I would be, you know, this letter, it wasn't sent to me. It was sent to everyone else in the press, in the free world, as far as I know. And so, of course, I got it about 40 minutes before going on my own radio show. And I think it's just, it's like if you had a mosquito in your tent and there were bears walking all around your tent and you decided that what you were going to do is take that mosquito out with a chainsaw. I mean, it's that appropriate. There have been rumors of an iceberg scandal. That's what it's been dubbed by numerous blogs, by legislators, by people in Alaska, that there was going to be some scandal coming on the governor. It's been, you know, I think they probably circulate on everybody. And that when she abruptly resigned, that those started to swirl back up because no one could believe that Sarah Palin was a quitter, that there must be something bigger. And they also didn't think she was, they thought she was a fighter. So how could it possibly be that the media, who had been pretty rough on her this week, or, you know, a joke from David Letterman or all these things, how could that possibly make her quit? She quit 17 months before the end of her term. So I guess that was, you know, I was just reporting on that. So
Well, tell us, what is it that you know about her that would suggest allegations of embezzlement, and that she
I
is
know,
trying
I
to...
I never said that. I've never said that.
Uh-huh.
So, but plenty of other people have.
Right. And what is this iceberg, then, that's looming? If she's trying to shut you up, even though you haven't said what she says you are going to say, and she's saying if you do say it, she'll sue you, what is it that's looming?
I wasn't being specific that there was. What I said was that was how Alaskans were explaining to each other that. But who cares what I said? It's censorship on the 4th of July.
Right. Right.
I mean, does anybody, like, that's the point.
Right. So in other words, you can't speak ill of her and suggest that people are wondering why the hell she quit when she says she's not a quitter, therefore they're speculating that maybe there's something that she's afraid of. Now, what's being done in terms of local moves? I know there's been some lots of ethics complaint. How much is she getting, if you can't stand the heat, get out of the kitchen? How much heat is there in Alaska on her?
You know, I don't think that... I think that, yeah, there have been ethics complaints filed on her, but she's filed them on herself. She did file one last year right after nominated, trying to derail the Branchflower report, and she released the findings of it, or her personnel board released the findings, on the day before the election. So if anyone's abused the ethics complaint system, it was her. That was just blatant. And then she said that the state of Alaska had spent millions of dollars on ethics complaints, and then that was debunked this week, and basically we found out that we have spent about, I think it was something like $295,000, and two-thirds of that was spent on the ethics complaint that she filed against herself.
Well, it's odd, Shannon, that she's going after you and not Todd Purdom. Her lengthy Vanity Fair story really was devastating. It suggested that she was, mentally erratic, and not to mention driving her political advisors crazy. And that in itself has created an inter Republican battle between Schmidt, the former McCain handler, and Sarah Palin's real political mentor, Bill Kristol.
Well, I was really surprised. I mean, there have been people that have come out and been really pointed about, oh, it's this and it's this for sure, and there's this going on and there's this going on. And they've written, Max Blumenthal had written on it, several other people. So it was kind of odd. I mean, I was actually shocked to see my name in there.
Well, it's reasonable to assume that Bill Kristol is still her advisor. He's the one who pushed the Republican establishment to take her seriously, and then presumably had some influence over McCain's decision to put her on as his VP. He, of course, is one of the uber neocons in this country, and his colleague Richard Pearl once said of George W. Bush that the great thing about George W. Bush is that he's an empty vessel and that we can fill him. And of course we've seen what that has brought. So it seems to me that the real villain, if you want to find a villain in this thing, is Bill Kristol, because he's basically cynically saying this is somebody that we can control who'll go out there and get votes and stir up the base. That seems to be the politics behind this.
Well, there have been so many politics on the outside, or these sort of agendas. I know that it was rumored that Bill Kristol was up here to see her last June before the nomination, that he had gone to Juneau. I had the same feeling about him, and thought, well, that's just not optimal for Alaska at all. And then the whole what's the difference between Sarah Palin and George Bush is lipstick, that was sort of that whole they can manipulate her and they're going to try really hard to get her in. Yeah, that's been sort of written about and thought about on a long range, but the sad thing for me as a citizen of Alaska is that this entire circus or orchestration by Bill Kristol or whatever, whatever the theory is behind it, is really detracted from, you know, some really fundamental energy crisis, fish runs crashes, people not getting what they need here. We have a lot of things that are being neglected over this sort of fight for the top on some future level. So for me, it's just been really sad to see Alaskans not have their needs met over political ambitions.
Well, presumably her resignation then is a good thing if for Alaska.
I think it is, because I think that she's been distracted and she has been, you know, on to other things for quite some time.
Mm. And the other visit, of course, that to Alaska, to the Palins, is Greta Van Susteren of Fox News, who essentially is stalking Todd Palin, the first dude. I mean, if ever there was a reporter in love with their subject.
It's awkward.
That's a good way of putting it.
I'll just say, whenever I watch her, it's just kind of awkward.
Yeah.
It's just kind of like...
Well, we've got a wrap here, Shannon, but I just want to get a sense of what the next step is. Here, you've been put on notice by Sarah Palin's lawyers not to talk about her, and essentially this is a kind of clumsy attempt at a restraining order. Are you going to go ahead and talk to Keith Olbermann and others? I mean...
I was already scheduled to be on Keith's show tomorrow. Before this letter, I'm fulfilling that commitment. I have other, you know, other media commitments. I got that letter yesterday and went on the air and did my show for 2 hours. And I'm sure that there are attorneys that would love to depose Sarah Palin.
Mm-hmm.
You know, so I'm not.
Go ahead and make my day. Is that what you're saying?
No, not so much. It doesn't make my day. I just think it's really part of a long pattern of trying to squish. You know, the little guy, like you said, she didn't go after Todd after the Vanity Fair piece that was really pretty remarkable in its slant.
Devastating, yeah.
You know, and so, you know, I'm looking at this, I'm like, I'm just a girl from Homer. I write on a blog and I have a radio show, and that's not national. So why come after me is, well, I don't know. I guess people... can sort of look at her pattern and figure out what they think. It's on Huffington Post what I wrote, and I stand by it.
Well, I thank you very much for joining us here in Los Angeles, Shannon Moore.
Ian, it's always lovely to talk to you.
And likewise. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Hello again, I'm Ian Marsett, speaking then with Shannon Moore, a progressive radio broadcaster from Anchorage, Alaska. She's interviewed Sarah Palin, the vice president nominee and governor, on a number of occasions, and just received a legal letter from Sarah Palin's lawyers suggesting that she shut up, in effect. But she's clearly not going to do that. I'm now speaking with Max Nyman, who's a senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California. He was a professor of political science at the University of California in Riverside and the author of Defending Government, Why Big Government Works. His most recent publication for the Public Policy Institute of California is Economic Development, The Local Perspective, which was published in 2009. And joining him is Todd Haggerty, who's a research analyst with the National Conference of State Legislatures based in Denver. Let's begin with Todd and get an overview that this fiscal crisis in California is it's not isolated. In fact, it's a national phenomenon and a rather disturbing one. Todd, how many states are in similar straits as the state of California?
Well, I think it's interesting to note that as states are crafting their fiscal year 2010 budgets, 42 states had to close a $121 billion cumulative budget gap. But as we've now since passed the new fiscal year for 46 states, we're left with 7 states in addition to California that are still working on finalizing their budgets for the next fiscal year.
And those 7 are Arizona, right?
Arizona, Connecticut, Illinois, Mississippi, North Carolina, Ohio, and Pennsylvania, in addition to California.
And is the common problem there lack of revenues because of the recession?
Almost certainly. We're seeing poor revenue performance just widespread across the country. More than half the states have reported to NCSO in our latest fiscal survey of legislative fiscal offices that year-to-date revenues from every major tax source were below collections compared to the same period last year, and many of those by some fairly significant margins.
And Max Nyman, we spoke a couple of months ago, I think it was, with you and with Bob Hertzberg, the former Speaker of the California Assembly, where we sort of talked about what was looming. And of course, since we spoke, things have gotten so much worse. I mean, they seem to get worse by the day here in California.
Absolutely, and not only are the revenues falling, but we're sort of caught up in the cycle in which. Basically, the combined effect of all the state actions and local actions are counter-cyclical in the sense that, in effect, they're blunting the effectiveness of the stimulus package, which, as everyone knows, now everyone is expecting perhaps the need for a second one because states and local governments are, in effect, laying off thousands and thousands of employees. That, of course, also causes many others to hunker down and worry about their jobs and consequently reduce spending even further. So this is all part of a national problem as well as a California problem. And I think to some extent, California, which has certain unique wrinkles to it, has kind of focused too much on its own uniqueness in this regard. And in fact, as we see, that there are a number of other states, relatively speaking, who are in worse shape than California is.
Well, I guess that's cold comfort, though.
No, it's not. It's not. But it's an indication of how grave the problem is.
Right.
We all know how horrid it is here, and of course it's horrid in a number of other places as well.
And there's going to be obviously a trickle-down effect with the state vendors are not going to get paid. The federal government does not want to set an example by bailing out California. They made that really clear. So we're on our own. And the only thing that I hear, and we spoke about it with last time with Bob Hertzberg, is this idea of a constitutional convention, which would be a catastrophe, would it not?
Well, launching a constitutional convention is a complicated endeavor. People are still discussing it. Some people are very strongly committed to it, but others, I think, are increasingly aware of the shortcomings. And the pitfalls of that approach and some of the key issues in California, I don't think, at least personally speaking, it may be worth looking at whether we really need a constitutional convention to address those specific problems.
And Todd Hagerty, obviously the constitutional convention is a response to the fact that California is unique, one of only three states in the union that require a two-thirds majority to pass a budget. They also have an extra provision in California, need a two-thirds majority for any tax increases. From your perspective, being a research analyst with the National Conference of State Legislatures, do you see California as being particularly vulnerable because, in effect, its political process is held hostage by the tyranny of the minority?
Well, you can also see in Illinois, which Illinois has a provision if they do not have a budget agreement in place by May 31st. After June 1st, it goes to a supermajority as well. So you're also seeing some of the same issues manifest in Illinois as well. But I think, again, this just kind of goes to the depth and how wide this recession is, that, you know, most states are in some pretty dire fiscal straits. And, you know, in addition to this fiscal year, though, 31 states are already projecting so far fiscal budget gaps for fiscal year 2011 as well. So this is an ongoing problem now. It appears that it's going to continue for some time.
And what do you make of New York? Are there problems sort of they're so it's almost like a circus there? Is that a political one as opposed to a fiscal one?
Well, I think that, you know, again, you see, like, different parties come with different priorities on these fiscal issues. And when you're facing just how these enormous budget gaps, you're seeing that states, you know, are having some really tough decisions to make. And unfortunately, this is causing some fairly tense and tough negotiations.
Uh-huh. Well, they're certainly the legislators in New York State aren't helping themselves. But Max Nyman, tell me about, am I correct in suggesting, though, that the sad and tragic thing about this situation in California is that it's almost like the reverse of the Titanic. You know, when the Titanic is sinking, it was women and children first to the lifeboats. It seems to me that reverse is happening here. It's the women and children who are getting nailed. They're cutting education and childcare and prenatal and all of those programs seem to be the first on the chopping block.
Yeah. Well, in some sense, you know, the particular slant that's in California, in which you basically have the Republican Party and the governor starting off with a position of either no tax increases or, in the case of the governor, his position, initial bargaining position, was to eliminate, not to cut, but to eliminate a number of these programs. And now the Democrats, you know, basically have moved from, you know, from a position of saying, well, we've drawn the line in the sand. Now they've said, well, we're shifting that line in the sand. And you know, if you were someone who is, let's say, a partisan on the Democrat side, you'd wonder why your team is so willing to give. You know, one side seems perfectly happy to see everything collapse and play, you know, not to blink at the end. I realize that you know, that I suppose if the Democrats and the electorate, you know, are willing to, you know, hold those responsible, you might get a more progressive outcome. But it strikes me that that the way the dynamic is working, the Democrats are basically conceding, and they have been conceding ever since last May, and then in February, and now again, it seems to me, here at this stage as well. So yes, women and children first, students, the environment, and global warming.
And Todd Haggerty, with these rest of the states in distress, what's happening there? In California, we're paralyzed over the argument of we can't raise taxes, therefore we have to borrow money. Now nobody will lend to us anymore, and so we have to then cut government services. What's the dynamic in the rest of the state? Is there anybody trying to raise taxes and being thwarted, or are they all just cutting services?
Well, unfortunately, this is being played out across the country, and you're seeing, you know, pretty much anything and everything is on the table for states. So you're seeing some program cuts to things like education and health care. But you're also seeing proposals to raise taxes in several states. Some of those have gone through. But again, it's such a, you know, a hot political item whenever you're making these dramatic cuts or tax increases that, it, you know, this is causing the holdup in some of the states that are still finalizing their budgets. And, you know, with fiscal year 2009 already closing $102 billion and closing $121 for fiscal year 2010, it's, you know, there's just been some very, very difficult decisions that states have had to make.
So when do you think citizens are going to start noticing that the potholes, the lack of response from, I mean, what's going to be the first to go if you can make that generalization?
Well, that's a hard one, but I mean, definitely you see like the items that might be the larger portions of the general fund, such as education, that they've been in higher education. You've seen a lot of action in regards to higher education, but I think that, you know, again, with just the dire fiscal straits, unless revenues improve, you're going to have to see the states taking a lot of...
Well, you know, in California, to make it very specific, although I'm not sure we can attribute it entirely to the state budget cuts, but clearly the 50-cent increase in fares for Muni and the monthly fares for FastPass, which are very substantial, are partly attributable to cutback in mass transportation. We have student fee increases at the universities and state universities. We're going to see more and more people showing up in county emergency rooms because of the cutbacks in county public health assistance. And so, yes, we're going to see these things. There are no such things as free lunches, including cutting services. And I suspect, to a degree, we'll see more people on the streets and which it implies. And so, yes, we do see these consequences, and budget cuts are not free. They do have their consequences on the quality of life, on property values, and on fees. We will see increased fees for parks and recreation facilities if those are to remain open. So, I I guess I'm to some extent disheartened by the inability of people to make clear what the consequences of these cuts are, never mind the effect it has on the overall macroeconomy.
Well, I must add to that, Max, and that is that it is so counterintuitive at a time when we're concerned about global warming and our dependence on foreign oil. We should be subsidizing public transport throughout the country in order to encourage people not to drive cars. And here's the reverse is happening, which is, you know, they're raising fares on people.
Well, insofar as people have an option, in many cases what we're talking about are people who only have the option of public transportation. They really can't afford car insurance or the high cost of properly using an automobile. And so in many cases it's not so much a question, partly, of course, encouraging public transportation for global warming changes, but a very high percentage of the people who use public transportation in places like Los Angeles and San Francisco or Phoenix or in Las Vegas, where really public transportation often is fairly onerous as a way of getting around, but still they simply have no choice. And so the costs are either going to be higher to them or they're simply going to not be able to have, or they'll wind up using clunky automobiles, drive without insurance, and do all of the things that we hope they won't do.
Well, just in closing, Todd Haggerty, what do you think is going to happen? Is the federal government going to have to bail out some of these states? They obviously don't want to get into that business. Or do you think the stimulus money is going to trickle down and reverse this trend that is so alarming? Just a minute, Tom.
Well, I definitely think that you raise the questions of federalism when you talk about state bailouts. But the one silver lining that we are hearing is that state finances would be in an even worse position if it weren't for the stimulus funds. So I think you're still in a kind of a wait and see period to see what the full effect is going to be. Yeah. And with the majority of that money starting to hit the states now and throughout the remainder of fiscal year 2010, hopefully we'll see some benefits.
Yeah, I hope so. That's my fervent wish. My only, what the data are telling me that at best, at least as far as states and localities are going to do, there may be some stimulus effect, but it's going to be greatly diminished by the fact that it'll either prevent some of these cuts, but it won't produce the stimulus. It'll just basically maybe at best hold us in place, which is not where we need to be.
I thank you both for joining us, gentlemen. Todd Haggerty, research analyst with the National Conference on State Legislatures, and Max Nyman, the senior fellow at the Public Policy Institute of California.
Always a pleasure.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you. And now let's turn to the subject of Iran and leftist confusion. We're joined by Reese Ehrlich, who's a freelance journalist and author. His books include the 2003 bestseller Target Iraq, What the News Media Didn't Tell You, and in 2007, The Iran Agenda, The Real Story of U.S. Policy and the Middle East Crisis. And last week he published an article entitled Iran and Leftist Confusion. Obviously, Reese Ehrlich, and you were there for the elections. You covered the elections in Iran. So let's begin with that, since you were there on the ground. I take it you were kicked out with the rest of the press, right?
Yes, my visa expired, and I had to leave. If you overstay your visa, you run the risk of being detained and forcibly expelled and otherwise being harassed. So, yes, on my 10th day, I was out of there. I think what I saw on the ground and where I think there's a lot of confusion among progressives and leftists in the U.S. is what is the nature of this opposition movement. Most people in this country support that movement and understand it's a very significant movement against the ruling clerics in Iran. But there's a small number of leftists who say, well, it's mostly an upper-middle-class movement, and it's probably being manipulated by the CIA and by others in power. It's a velvet revolution, and we shouldn't support it, or at least we should be very suspicious about it. And what I saw on the ground is that actually, while the core of support for Mousavi, particularly in the beginning, was among upper-middle-class folks, intellectual students and so on, it very quickly transcended that and became a multi-class movement against the clerical government in Iran, and that was that became obvious after the election and before all the crackdown and repression, where there were marches in South Tehran, which is the working class neighborhood, where there were demonstrations all throughout Iran among workers, among women, among lots of different folks. This pent up anger at the government was being expressed.
But it seems to me, Rees Alek, that this is, and I'm surprised that there's not more analysis of this in our press. It seems to me so clear that this is an IRGC coup, that Ahmadinejad is a front man for the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps. He was a previous member, and they've simply they've been the power behind the scenes, and now they've just stepped out, and that's it. We're in charge.
Yeah, I think that's accurate. When I was in Iran, and the morning of the after the election results were announced, I talked to many people who said it's been a coup. They could not. It's physically impossible that Ahmadinejad got all the votes that were claimed. There's now very credible reports coming out about ballot box stuffing and printing more ballots than were than had their proper registration numbers, and lots of other ballot rigging devices. And yes, I think, and that's perhaps that's also a source of confusion for some progressives, is that you have a big fight within the ruling elite in Iran, and Mousavi himself was not all that progressive or even all that radically different from the Ahmadinejad and the other rulers, but he represented an opposition force that lots of different kinds of people united around. And so you have this very deep split. Like, it was just yesterday that there was a statement from the Assembly of Qom Seminary Scholars and Researchers, a very ordinarily conservative group, which called into question the elections and disputed Khamenei's characterization of the election. So there's a very deep split, and as you said, part of it is the ruling clerics are being supplanted by the intelligence and Revolutionary Guard forces as represented by Ahmadinejad. So there's a very fierce resistance coming even from moderate and conservative clerics.
And specifically, it seems to be Mujtaba Khamenei, the son of the supreme leader, who's joined at the hip with Ahmadinejad, and he's also essentially runs the intelligence services and the IRGC. That seems to be where the nexus is.
Yes, the only people capable of rigging an election like this on this kind of massive scale were Ahmadinejad's forces in collusion with the intelligence and the Revolutionary Guard and the Basiji. Let's not forget this kind of quasi-religious right-wing thugs, or militia, as they're sometimes described, who were used as the shock troops to go out and beat up people and kill people, including Neda, the woman who's become so famous now because of the cell phone video of her being shot for no reason, having just simply stepped out of her car during a demonstration. And yes, those folks are not satisfied with the old ruling elite, as represented by Rafsanjani and some of the more traditional clerics. So there's a very fierce and very bitter fight going on among them. But that simply opens up lots of opportunities for ordinary people who are not necessarily in either camp. And that's who we saw out in the streets in their millions demonstrating in the week between the announcement of the election results and the crackdown, roughly a week later.
And so how does this play out, though, in terms of the global left, as you mentioned in your article about confusion on the left? I mean, I recall back in the days of the Balkan War in the Balkans, American left was split, and so I assume the rest of it was. The more Stalinist people were in favor of Milosevic, even though he was basically conducting a genocide that Europe hadn't seen since the Nazis. And then the progressive left. I don't even quite sure about how you pass the left. help me out here,
Rees. KPFA, who are parsing the left even as we speak.
Oh, I know. Well, I was up in the Bay Area this week, and I heard Parenti being interviewed, and it's so depressing. You know, the thing about the left in this country is they don't do their homework. I'd never heard such empty drivel. You know,
but speaking on the question of Iran, I think the argument goes something like this. And remember, this is still a very small number of people, because I had my article now has been reprinted all over the place, every place from Michael Moore and Truthout and Down with Tyranny and all kinds of folks have published it. And the argument goes something like this. The U.S. has a long history of intervention in Iran. That's true. It overthrew Mossadegh in 1953. That's true. The Bush administration had a policy of overthrowing or attempting to overthrow the government by using particularly ethnic minorities. I've written about that in my book, The Iran Agenda. That's true. And then from there, the leap is, well, then obviously these demonstrations were manipulated by the CIA. And that's where the logic falls apart. And it's based on, given that there's this history of it, it must be true now in this situation as well, without actually analyzing the specific conditions in Iran and looking carefully at what those folks are actually doing, what they're demanding. You know, I was out in the streets with people talking to them, and they are not there as part of a velvet revolution to bring in a pro-CIA government. They are out there demanding basic freedoms. They are opposed to a clerical government. They would like to see either some kind of a modified Muslim government, an Islamic republic with more rights, or a parliamentary government. They don't support the U.S. demands to end nuclear building nuclear power. They don't agree with the U.S. demands to stop supporting Hamas and Hezbollah. And all the key demands that the U.S. is making have no support anywhere in Iran, including in the streets. So the idea that somehow this is a velvet revolution manipulated by the CIA is just absurd. I mean, the CIA is doing a horrible job. All these people still oppose U.S. policy.
Well, that's, if you talk to people in the CIA, they always say, well, you know, we like to take credit for everything that the left accuses us of.
Yeah,
but
really.
The truth of the matter is, more often than not, they're the gang that can't shoot straight, you know.
Yeah, and, you know, they didn't, never predicted the first 1979 revolution. They certainly didn't predict the fall of the Soviet Union. I mean, particularly the conspiracy theorists, and I'm not saying everybody on the left who has questions about Iran is a conspiracy theorist, but those who are give way too much credit to the CIA and completely underestimate the popular movement.
Right, and these are the people that are being shot and beaten by these religious thugs. And, you know, to understand that in an American context, you'd have to figure, you know, that you'd have a cabal of theocrats led by Falwell, Robinson, Hagee, and Dobson, who use people like the anti-abortion zealot who shot the doctor in his church as their enforcers.
Right, and then they to follow the analogy, they would then put out in the media that the doctor was shooting at his assailant prior and that it was all self-defense.
Right.
That's what they do. They say, you know, the Basiji break into the universities, they kill students, they beat them up inside their dorm rooms, and then they claim that the Basiji were under attack. And so if you're inside Iran and you don't have access to external media of any kind, which is actually less and less the case, then you're getting this total distorted view of reality. Then you go watch Iranian TV, and the people who were beaten up or jailed are forced to make these public confessions. And they said, yes, I was hired by the British, or yes, I was hired by the CIA. And they're totally absurd. Internally, the confessions make no sense. But it convinces a certain number of folks. And there's no question about it that Ahmadinejad does have a certain populist appeal. And he did obviously receive popular votes, not in the numbers that he claims.
Yeah, he actually may have squeaked by. You never know.
The point is we don't know because the election, there were so many problems
right.
with the election.
Well, he, essentially what's happening there is the IRGC and Khamenei's son and Ahmadinejad are taking the Republic out of the Islamic Republic. And the one thing the Iranian people had chafing under the mullahs was a democracy, a vote. And then they took that away from them.
Well, there's a difference between having a vote and having a democracy.
Yeah, exactly.
The people of Iraq and Afghanistan well know.
Well, it's true. And it's hardly a democracy all the candidates had to be vetted by the ultra-conservative.
Yeah, exactly. And not only that, you could be a sitting member of parliament who had been vetted and approved in the previous election. You're sitting in parliament, you're planning to run again for re-election, and the council suddenly decides that you're no longer Islamic enough, and you're barred from running. And that happened to a lot of the reformist candidates in previous parliamentary elections. So they had lots of ways to manipulate the vote. It certainly was no democracy, although there certainly was voting.
Right. Well, you covered the 2005 elections, and
exactly.
Ahmadinejad barely edged out Mehdi Karoubi.
Yeah, and Karoubi at the time said there was vote fraud.
Right, right. And Karoubi, of course, is a bona fide Ayatollah, as yes. opposed to the supreme leader doesn't really have his religious chops, does he?
No, he's, shall we say, a faux Ayatollah?
Right.
A wannabe Ayatollah?
Right.
They had to go back. I mean, I don't know how much your listeners follow this sort of thing, but when Khamenei was, because he was a former, basically a politician, a clerical politician, and when it came up that time to anoint him as the supreme leader, he didn't have the religious credentials. So it'd be like a pope, or I don't know, was being chosen from among the priests rather than from among the cardinals, if we could make an analogy to the Catholic Church. So there was a big hubbub, and he suddenly was, they rewrote the rules and made him an Ayatollah of sufficient weight to be able to hold the job. But even to this day, he's resented by many of the real Ayatollahs and the other clerics for having done that.
Well, just to get back to the... your article, Reese Ehrlich, about leftist confusion as a result of what's happening in Iran. I think the biggest loser in all this surely is Hugo Chavez, who obviously has a lot of tremendous following at Pacifica Radio.
It just proves you that people who do good things in general can be wrong on on other things.
Yeah, well, let me just quote though from the Venezuelan foreign ministry, the official government position here on Iran. The Bolivarian government of Venezuela expresses its firm opposition to the vicious and unfounded campaign to discredit the institutions of the Islamic Republic of Iran, unleashed from outside, designed to roil the political climate of our brother country. From Venezuela, we denounce these acts of interference in the internal affairs of the Islamic Republic of Iran, while demanding an immediate halt to the maneuvers to threaten and destabilize the Islamic revolution. So what's going on here? Is there a kind of a counter-reliance of the bad guys, Chavez, Ahmadinejad? I noticed that Ahmadinejad was in Yekaterinburg, formerly Sverdlovsk, meeting at the time of the coup in Iran with Medvedev and the Chinese president.
Right, yeah. I think it's worth noting that neither the Cuban government nor the Chinese government, as far as I can been able to determine, have taken that same position. They've kind of taken a no-comment, wait-and-see attitude towards going. They haven't supported the demonstrations. Neither have they denounced them as being, you know, manipulated by imperialist powers. I have not interviewed anybody from the Venezuelan government. I have only their public statements to go by. So, but I have reported from Venezuela several times. And I think what it is that obviously the U.S. is antagonistic towards Iran. In the past, it has tried to overthrow the government there. And Ahmadinejad has tried to build some ties in Latin America. He's visited Cuba. He's visited Venezuela and other parts of South America. And there is this kind of de facto alliance, if you will, not because of any ideological support or a coincidence. Chavez is a radical social democrat. The Cubans are Marxist-Leninists. Ahmadinejad is a right-wing, religious-based populist. In practical matters, they all are hated by the U.S., so they have something in common. And I think the Venezuelans misjudged the situation and saw the demonstrations and said, aha, it must be something similar to what happened when the U.S. tried to overthrow Chavez in 2002 and used mass demonstrations as a way to try to discredit the Chavez government, even though they were manipulated by both the Venezuelan elite and with support from the United States. And I think they said, aha, it must be happening again in Iran. Mm-hmm. And I think they're simply wrong.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Reese Ehrlich.
My pleasure. Yes.
Thank you. Hello again. I'm Ian Masters, just speaking with Reese Ehrlich, a freelance journalist and author. He just returned from Iran, where he was covering the elections, and last week he published an article entitled Iran and Leftist Confusion. And I'm now speaking with Michael Shifter, who's Vice President for Policy and Director of the Andean Program at the Inter-American Dialogue since 1993. He's been an adjunct professor at Latin American Politics at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. He writes and comments widely on Latin American relations, and Hemispheric Affairs, and he is also co-editor, along with Jorge Dominguez, of Constructing Democratic Governance in Latin America, published by Johns Hopkins University Press. Since 1996, he has regularly testified before Congress about U.S. policy towards Latin America. And just following on from Reese Ehrlich's discussion about confusion on the left in both here in the United States and in Europe and around the world, do you think Chavez's support for Ahmadinejad has left egg on his face internationally, and has it affected him domestically?
Well, I think people in Venezuela are primarily interested in the situation in Venezuela, which is not good. I think this is completely predictable, his support for Ahmadinejad. I think he's, as was said before, I think he sees himself as somebody who wants to defy U.S. power, and Ahmadinejad has been a strong ally in that effort. So I would have been surprised if he didn't support Ahmadinejad. I don't think it hurts him too much at home. I think it's a diversion, but I don't think he's already in trouble for other reasons at home, and I don't think this really is a significant political issue domestically.
Well, he did. Chavez did try and get out ahead of condemning the coup in Honduras, about which we're going to speak here. But he was, I think, pretty much undercut by Obama, was he not?
Well, I think Obama was, he wasn't used to, and I think didn't expect that Obama would come out so firmly and so quickly, also condemning the coup. So that kind of neutralized Chavez. Chavez wanted to seize the opportunity and sort of drive this issue, and I think Obama played it very smartly by coming out so quickly, which is what the U.S. hasn't done in the past in Latin America, certainly didn't do in the case of Venezuela itself in 2002, when Chavez himself was the victim of a coup. So I think this was Obama's, I think, smart diplomacy is a bit frustrating for Chavez. He's not used to that. He's not used to dealing with somebody like that. So I don't think it's hurt him too badly, but I think having the United States taking a stand in favor of democracy in Honduras, I think has removed one of the main sources of attack of Chavez that has helped sustain his political position.
So, Michael Shifter, at this point, it seems to be a kind of a standoff in Honduras. Apparently, the authorities have closed the airport and restricted airspace over the national capital. They'll say they will arrest the deposed leader if he returns. He's supposed to return with a couple of heads of state from Latin America. Do you know anything further?
No, that's basically what I know, that he seems to be determined to go back, but the Honduran de facto government in Honduras seems equally, if not more, determined not to let him in, and if he does get in, that they would detain him, they would arrest him. So what I do think, the only thing in addition to that, is I do think there have been some, while there's been unanimous support in condemning the coup in Honduras, there are some differences now that are emerging about how to move forward. And I know the Canadian government, for example, is saying that this is perhaps not a good idea to go back, that this is, would further fuel the confrontation, make matters worse. So I think that is beginning to be the debate. But I, as far as I know, Zelaya, President Zelaya, seems absolutely intent on going back, that he's a legal, legitimate president of Honduras. But there are some voices that are now emerging saying, wait a minute, including the Catholic Church in Honduras, saying that we also have to worry about the situation of violence and things getting out of hand. And there is a legal argument, but there's also an argument for just maintaining public order and trying to avoid bloodshed.
So Zelaya is an unusual leftist populist, is he not? If that's a proper label, because he's a wealthy landowner, cattle and timber, and one of the problems about Honduras, which is, you know, fairly common in Latin America and Central America, is the power of oligarchs and a few families controlling all of the wealth, etc. And isn't Honduras pretty much an exemplar of that?
Yes, I think Zelaya was somebody who was elected in November of 2005, not seen as a radical populist, certainly wasn't aligned with Chavez at that point. And then a couple of years into his term, for a variety of reasons, he moved in that direction. Part of the problem is that Honduras was just battered economically, and so Chavez was offering preferential prices on oil, and so there was an economic alliance, and just for pragmatic reasons, he moved in that direction, and then, of course, tried to also carry out some more populist programs and employed rhetoric that sounds like Chavez's as well. So there was a shift from what he got in, and his background doesn't suggest that he would be in line with Chavez. Certainly the other members of Chavez's coalition and alliance in Latin America have very different backgrounds, but I think for a variety of reasons, just the circumstances and just economic and pragmatic reasons, he moved in that direction once he was already in office.
But it seems to be this is a sort of series of miscalculations, if you will, from people who are maximalists. You know, there's no sort of middle ground here. I mean, he called for the referendum. The Supreme Court supposedly gave orders to the military to arrest him. In other words, why not go through some kind of constitutional process like an impeachment?
Well, the Honduran Constitution doesn't provide for impeachment, but I do think there are other legal mechanisms, and I think, you know, you're absolutely right to say that this is overreaching on all sides. And I think that Zelaya tried to push this. He defied the decision and the will of institutions, of the Supreme Court, of the Congress, and he persisted. And so that, I think, provoked the institutional crisis. And then, of course, the way that the military did this just was so reminiscent of sort of the worst period in Latin American history that it obviously was a coup, because this wasn't obviously the institutional constitutional way to carry out this problem. So they went too far. And I think you're right. I think one thing led to another there. And unfortunately, my concern now, moving forward, is that we still may be in a maximalist logic. In the sense that certainly there was a stand taken by the Organization of American States and the international community, and Europe has removed its ambassadors. There has been this unified position, which is fine. But now we have to figure out how to move back and restore some legality and some order and calm things down in Honduras. And I think people have to take a deep breath. Instead, it seems to be pushing a little bit, talking about cutting off assistance, suspending Honduras from the Organization of American States, going back and perhaps risking further unrest there. So I think that really all of those considerations, I think, have to be weighed very, very carefully. And I think you're absolutely right in your characterization. I think there was maximalism on all sides, and this thing just kind of escalated. And hopefully cooler heads will now prevail, and the Obama administration will begin to try to influence the situation so that the situation calms down.
Well, it would seem, Michael Schifter, that there's a lot of ammunition, if you will. Perhaps that's the wrong way of putting it. There's a lot of influence out there to calm things down and to make the Honduran government, the one that's in now, and the military come to their senses because of international isolation, surely. In other words, wouldn't it be better for Zelaya just to keep quiet for a while?
Well, I think that's right, and I think it probably would have been better not to issue an ultimatum, because that just led the other side to dig in. And if both sides dig in, that's harder to get out of the hole. So I think I think that would have been the right thing. I don't know to what extent the Obama administration, which does have great influence, is really working behind the scenes in this effort. I know that they were concerned that this coup would happen. They tried to head it off And I think they miscalculated and misread the situation. It was much worse, and things were already set in motion in Honduras to have this happen. But you're right, Honduras is extremely poor. It's the third poorest country in the hemisphere. It's very vulnerable. It's not going to be able to survive in international environment. It's already very difficult, and it needs support from the U.S. And it's gotten support from Venezuela and other governments. So it's they do have a lot of leverage, but it depends, I think, how they employ that leverage. And my fear and concern is that it's just been a little bit too much of sort of issuing ultimatums and saying you have to do this, and rather than trying to see whether they can work out some sort of deal, some sort of compromise and formula that would be acceptable to all sides, perhaps just wait some more time rather than rush this when passions are so high.
And I guess the bigger issue, the underlying issue, is one that we perhaps should discuss at another time. But, I mean, seriously, the disparity of wealth in these countries is pretty appalling. Right. And the concentration of wealth in the hands of few families. Even next door in Mexico, it's always been a problem there under the PRI, of course, who are rather corrupt. But, you know, now you've got, Carlos Slim, one of the richest guys in the world. That process seems to inexorably continue, does it not?
Yeah, I think the structures have not really changed fundamentally. You do have some progress on the political front, and now you have elected governments. But the disparity, you know, Latin America is still the world, leading the world, according to all the World Bank and others, in inequality. And that gap persists despite progress in other areas. And that's the source of, that's a formula for continued instability and polarization, which is the cause of these kinds of interruptions of constitutional government. I think until you really address that and narrow that gap, there's going to be enormous risks for this kind of instability, as we're seeing now in Honduras. That is the underlying problem.
I thank you very much for joining us in Los Angeles, Michael Schifter.
My pleasure. Thank you.
Again, I'm Ian Masters, and I was speaking there with Michael Schifter, the Vice President of Policy and Director of the Andean Program for the Inter-American Dialogue, and he's also a Professor of Latin American Politics at Georgetown University School of Foreign Service. I thank Alan Minsky for help with production here today. He's this KPFK Senior Producer. Anthony Castillo, the Assistant Producer, and Melisa Figueroa, the Engineer.